Okay, we're starting. We have a wonderful turnout. Welcome, everyone. We're starting partly because we've run out of chairs. So that's good. I'm Kim Sichel. Welcome to the American New England Studies program if you have not yet joined us. What we're going to do today is to talk about the notion of the contact zone, and we're also going to have a party, which is the beginning of our year welcome party. So before I do anything else, I'd just like to quickly go around the room, and if you could say who you are so that those of you who don't know each other can learn who you are. And I think we'll start, Melanie, with you.
I'm Melanie Hall, Art History and Museum Studies.
I'm Keith Morgan, History of Architecture and History of Art and Architecture Department.
Tessa Croke, second year PhD, American Studies.
George Bourne, third year American Studies PhD.
Zach Violet, sixth year American Studies PhD.
Eliza Kane, a prospective student for the doctoral program with emphasis in literature.
Welcome.
Katie Evans Pritchard, and I'm a first year PhD.
Kathleen Daly, fifth year.
Karen Robbins, fourth year.
Claire Dempsey, American Studies faculty.
Will Moore, faculty in art and architectural history and American Studies, first year.
And we are welcoming you to our Okay.
Colin Root, advanced year. American Studies.
I'm Jerry Chankin, fourth year PhD American Studies.
Eric Jarvis, also advanced in age.
Hard time. Kim Sichel, director of the program, and History of Art and Architecture Department.
Nikki Lafayette, third year American Studies.
Carrie Corrigan, first year master's student in History of Art and Architecture.
Marilyn Hoffman, Director of Graduate Studies in the program, and Professor of History and Research Associate at the Institute on Culture, Religion, and World Affairs.
Cynthia Becker, Professor of African Art History in the History of Art and Architecture Department.
Tom Otten, English.
Okay, Sam, we're introducing ourselves. Let's just start with you.
I'm Sam Shoup. I'm an American New England Studies PhD student, first year.
I'm Emma Newcomb, American Studies PhD, and this is also my first year.
First year, so I have to stay on, you know.
And I'm Rosa, CS student. I'm a freshman. I just heard news from the website. I just came in.
Welcome, welcome. That's what we like to hear.
Carla Lee, last year art education.
Erin Nolan, I'm a second year master's student in history of art and architecture.
I'm Casey Riley. I'm a third year PhD student in American Studies.
I'm Marie McDonough. I'm faculty in the English department.
And I'm Kate Kozelka, second year master's art history.
Well, welcome, everyone. I'm sorry we ran out of chairs. This year's series, which is formally called Revisiting the Contact Zone, Postcolonial Responses to American Exceptionalism. This series is part of I'm going to read something a little formal just to introduce some issues and then open things up for discussion. This year's series is part of an ongoing focus in the American and New England Studies program to reach out to global cultures and their complicated intersections with American culture. As a field, American Studies is interdisciplinary, as you all know, combining history, English, history of art, and increasingly anthropology, sociology, political science, and archaeology in our approach. And of course, BU as a whole is increasing its focus on global and transnational studies, something that the American and New England Studies program has been doing for many years already. A few years ago, when Professor Anita Patterson was the director of American Studies, she's in the English department, she began our formal programmatic involvement with this expanded field of studies, which many of us have been doing on our own for many years, with a conference on globalism. So in some way, this year's series continues that focus, but expands the notion of transnationalism to contact zones that include intranational, as well as international contact zones. So I just want to review, for those of you who may not have gotten the many emails, what the talks are during the course of the autumn. On the 26th of September, Susan Kern from the College of William and Mary will be speaking on Thomas Jefferson Vernacular Studies and Contact Zones in Late Colonial Virginia. So there is a localized kind of series of contact zones. On the 19th of October, two of our colleagues at BU, Marilyn Halter from the History Department, will talk on African and American, post-colonial West Africans, and the remaking of the Atlantic world in the U.S. And Cynthia Becker in the Department of Art and Architecture will talk about From the Back Streets to Main Street, the changing aesthetics of the New Orleans Mardi Gras Indians. So both of them work on issues most broadly and probably inaccurately defined as diaspora issues, and the intersections of non-American culture and American cultures and their hybrids. And I think it'll be very interesting to see the intersections of what they're both working on. Did I get that more or less? Okay.
Intercultural hybrid.
Okay, good.
Diaspora.
On November 7th, we have a film director by the name of Anne Makepeace, who's the director of a film called We Still Live Here as Nutianian, which is about the Wampanoag and the recovery of Wampanoag languages, which is our attempt to make sure that we talk about Native American and Anglo-American, that's the term I tend to use, Euro-American contact zones. On December 1st, Anna Pegler-Gordon from Michigan State University will be talking about Chinese exclusion and photographic arts of contact and evasion. And in the spring semester, Isabel Wilkerson, who teaches in the College of Communication and is the head of the non-narrative writing program, will be talking about her new wonderful book, The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration. And we'll have other speakers from on campus, including William Moore, Anita Patterson, and several other people in the spring term as well. So as you can see, we'll talk about Mary Louise Pratt's ideas of the contact zone today, but I have exploded it in my own thinking to include all of these various kinds of topics, and I would encourage us to try to think about doing that, or shoot me down if you disagree with that notion. So just a couple of thoughts. Mary Louise Pratt teaches in the Spanish and Portuguese Language Department and Literature Department at New York University. Her 1992 book, Imperial Eyes, Travel Writing and Transculturation, is almost 20 years old, and to me, and in some of my classes, in fact, this morning's class, the graduate class, it seems to usefully set the vocabulary for a creative look at relations between powerful and less powerful cultures within and between American cultures and America and the rest of the world. So I think and I hope that her terms might be expanded for our use and form the base for this year's series. So I'd like to set out her outline of terms and then open this up for discussion for a few minutes and as long as we'd like, and then there's food and drink, which is much more important. This is meant to be very, very informal. I'm sure some of you will have better models to suggest, and I'm not trying to suggest this is the only theoretical model we should think about. It just seems to be one to get the conversation started in the same way that in last year's series, House and Home in American Culture, we read Bachelard, The Poetics of Space, to get our conversation started. So I'm not trying to drum this as the best or the most useful theoretical approach to this, but just one of many that I find quite useful. So there's certainly a long and distinguished history of people writing about post-colonial issues, from Edward Said to Gayatri Spivak to Dipesh Chakrabarty to a whole number of other writers, and I'm not trying to make one person more important than any other. Pratt begins her book with two examples to show how broadly she feels her terms can be used. One's a faded letter from Dr. Livingstone in a Listowel, Ontario drugstore belonging to his great-grandnephew, and the faded and recurrent image of the name Livingstone to echo the famous missionary in Africa, Dr. Livingstone, I presume. In this provincial Canadian town, it's in the letter, it's the name of a retirement home of a street. In what Mary Louise Pratt calls redundance, discontinuity, and unreality, some of the chief coordinates of the text of Euro-imperialism that she sees as having a very wide net. The second example she uses, which has, frankly, nothing really to do with American studies per se, is a text, and please forgive my pronunciation, by Felipe Guaman Poma de Ayala from Cuzco from 1613, a 1,200-page letter, partly in Quechua and partly in rough Spanish, written to King Philip of Spain with 800 pages of text and 400 drawings. It's titled The New Chronicle of Good The New Chronicle and Good Government and Justice. Then it's a new view of the world that includes indigenous American peoples in the history of Christendom and a revisionist account of the Spanish conquest. It resides in the Danish Royal Archives, very, very far removed from its original site, and was found only in 1908, published only around 1937, and discussed fully only in the 1970s. So out of this, she finds that there's an issue of texts that can be read and that are readable. And so that's also something, I think, for us to think about. And she sets out three sets of terms that I find quite useful, and some of you may or may not agree. One is the notion of the contact zone. And she says, quote, "These are social spaces where disparate cultures meet, clash, and grapple with each other, often in highly asymmetrical relations of domination and subordination." And so in a closer definition, she calls it, quote, "the space of a colonial encounters, the space in which peoples geographically and historically separated come into contact with each other and establish ongoing relations, usually involving conditions of coercion, radical inequality, and intractable conflict." She uses the word contact, coming originally from its linguistic use. Contact language, she says, refers to improvised languages among speakers of native different languages that begin as pidgins, and they're called Creoles when they come to have native speakers of their own. And I'm assuming that Cynthia is going to be able to help us with that notion of a Creole construction. She sees the contact zone as something interactive and improvisational, multi-directional, bottom-up as well as top-down, and in my image, she sees that messy intersection as the area where interesting things happen, and so that's what I think is quite interesting as well. She's interested in European, read Euro-American for our purposes, economic and political expansion since 1750, and she says that her book hopes to be both a study in genre and a critique of ideology. So she wants to know how travel writings produce the notion of the image. Then she uses a couple of other terms, transculturation, a term which originally, as Marilyn has reminded me, comes from Ferdinand Ortiz in the 1950s and has been in
common.
Oh, I'm just reading from the footnote, sorry.
That's 1940s.
Angel Roma brought it into use in literary studies in the 1970s. And what Pratt writes about transculturation is, quote, "Ethnographers have used this term to describe how subordinated or marginal peoples select and invent from the material transmitted to them by a dominant or metropolitan culture. Transculturation is a phenomenon of the contact zone. It's a dialectic and a historicized approach to travel writing." She uses the term anti-conquest to talk about bourgeois subjects, in her words, who seek to secure their innocence at the same moment as they assert a European hegemony. And she uses the term autoethnography, where she writes, quote, "There are instances in which colonized peoples undertake to represent themselves in ways that engage with the colonizer's own terms, partly collaborating with and partly appropriation of the idioms of the conquerors." So those are some of the terms that I think might be useful in starting a conversation about what a contact zone is, and that's where my term comes from. My suggestion is for our purposes in American and New England studies that we look, among other things, and I hope you'll broaden my definition, contact zones between Europe and America, between other nations and America, between black and white cultures, between North and South America, between rich and poor, between North and South, between Native American and Euro or Anglo-American, between East and West, and so on. So I'm trying to broaden it out quite broadly. So my question to all of you is that a useful model, and how might we use that in talking about contact zones? And we have an Islamicist come to join us who's not an Americanist at all, but who also works in the notion of the contact zone between European and other cultures. So, and Cynthia's actually teaching a course this term called contact zone, so maybe you can tell us why you named your course that.
Well, I called it Material Journeys, and I can't remember, colon, and something, something, something. I think contact zone is in there. But for me, the issue of contact zone isn't necessarily have to be a European or American encounter with my so-called minority or indigenous population. I looked at contact zones within the African continent itself. And so my question to my class was, can we use this Pratt model and apply it to contact between different African cultures? Because one of the ways that people look at African art typically is people classify art objects as being representative of a particular tribal group or a particular ethnic group, and they don't view them as part of a historical encounter between different groups. So people love to look at African art objects and believe that they come from some remote village, everybody still believing in an indigenous religion, without taking into consideration that African so-called tribes have been in contact with larger state structures for generations, for centuries, and that you have contact not only between Europeans and Africans that go back to the 14th century within the continent, but you also have contact between North Africa, Islamic cultures, and West Africa, also on the East African coast. And so my course focuses on regions where you see a lot of this contact happening. So trade routes across the Sahara, for example, coastal areas. So we're looking at the Portuguese contact with West Africa. It goes back to the 15th century. Then we're looking at the diaspora. We're just doing a couple of case studies. We're looking at Haiti and New Orleans. So I think it's a great model, and I don't think it necessarily has to be applied to European and American encounters with indigenous peoples. I think you can apply it, take it and apply it in other ways. And for me, it's very helpful in breaking down stereotypes that people have about African art.
I really agree with that. And in terms of the list you just concluded with of what contact zones could encompass and try to broaden out, I think we can also look inward, and I think you use the word intracultural.
Intra, yes.
And you know, we're the American and New England Studies program, and yet I discovered through the first couple of classes with the incoming group of doctoral students that are there 4 out of the 10 of you who are interested in Southern studies in some form or another? And so those intra-American or encounters and borrowings and the kind of regional cultural hybridity or the interactions and dynamics between the local and the global, which is so much informs recent American studies scholarship, I think lends itself to.
I think Isabel Wilkerson's book upon the Great Migration, which is about the migration of Southern African Americans
right,
to the
yes,
North,
that'll be
is
perfect,
a really interesting example of that. So.
Right, and I think that it's very, I mean, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think it's very hard to define intraculture because having come from North Carolina, I'll tell you that there are many people in the American South who feel as though they've been colonized by the North.
Yeah.
Right, and that there is this imperial aspect of the North coming into the South and
absolutely.
And treating the South the way empires have treated other places. I mean, I'm not sure I see it, but it's a very much part of their consciousness that they feel as though they're a victimized people.
And so for us Northern academics, it's particularly important with so many people interested in Southern studies to think about the fact that we are looking with the eye of a colonizer unconsciously and maybe factor that in somehow. And we talked about that in class this morning. Erin, were you talking about that in Turkish?
Yeah, I think I was just suggesting that some of the case studies that we were reading in class today, which had mostly to deal with the British photographer Francis Frith. The scholarship on it was written by art historians who are trained in a Western modernist discourse, and so they don't seem to, even though they're critiquing the colonial approach to photography, they don't realize and don't acknowledge that, for example, there were Ottoman photographers who had studios in Cairo at the same time that Frith did, and so that there was contact and similar experiences that were going on then. So it seems as though that sort of left out of the recent scholarship.
I think you can domesticate this even further. Now, listening to this conversation makes me realize that the work I'm doing in the various layers of Brookline and its class, professionalism, racial, ethnic, interpenetration of different communities, that a lot of that is a type of colonizing from one direction or another, at least transcultural accommodation. So I don't think you have to sort sort of get out of the United States or radically change environments to see the value for this kind of model.
And even the way gentrification is the direction we tend to study, but even the way in which neighborhoods become impoverished and slum-like is another kind of contact zone which the academy tends not to study so much, except for sociology, maybe.
I've been looking at, in some respects, I think I can call myself a contact zone.
And Emmy May and Cynthia.
But it's Anglo-American, not in the sense that you would understand Anglo-American. In that sense, I would have to call myself a British American, but I would call myself Anglo and American because I'm now dual national. And one of the things I've been looking at is Americans visiting sites in Britain and Anglo-American sites, such as Niagara Falls. And I've been looking at travel literature. And one of the problems that I've encountered is actually the language, and it's language and law, and the idea of the public domain and entail. And it's taken me quite a while to sort of work through this, but one of the things that I would say is, when looking at travel literature isn't neutral. It carries a whole set of associations about place and about sort of ownership of place and whether that's how the public ownership of place is being perceived. So in America, that has one set of meanings, and in Britain, it has another set of meanings. So the same word can actually, depending on whether you're using British English or American English, the same word can actually have oppositional meanings. And this struck me, it took me a long time to work this out, to actually understand it. But depending on which type of travel literature or which type of English the travel literature is actually using, can radically alter its meaning.
I think that's where it's quite useful when Pratt talks about that Quechua prose. It's such an extreme example. It kind of reminds us of the complications of language.
Yes. And she's writing about Canada, which
right, but in that, that's the Quechua 16th century, 17th century documents found in Quechua. Emily's waving her hand back here.
Oh, no, I was just...
But I think another really important idea, I don't know if she uses the word agency or not, but giving the colonizing people a voice. And as someone, I do a lot of field work in Africa, you really have to consider the so-called, minority, the subject or whoever, the African voice in everything you do, because people know, they're aware of the literature, they look at photographs that people are taking of them and bringing them back to Europe and America. So this idea of autoethnography, I think, is so great. And it really gives agency to the African or the Quechuan speaker or whoever, the so-called.
That was interesting, too, for some of the things that I work on, where today in class, actually, we're talking about the city of Constantinople and its fall into Ottoman hands. And the Ottoman ruler who's responsible for the takeover, he's very careful about constructing an image of himself by inviting Italian artists to make not only an oil portrait but also coin-sized medals of him, because this is the way in which rulers in Europe at the time communicate their notions of grandeur to each other. So in a way, he's also using this language, kind of autoethnography, not ethnography, but just that term or the senses that it brings up, I thought were really resonant in that context as well. To talk awareness of this other language that other people use and the ability to use that language to present yourself in the ways that you want to be presented, but in their terms for a different audience.
Yeah, jumping off of that, actually, I think one of the most obvious ways to use the contact zone model in a modern globalized sense is to talk about how technology gives us this immaterial contact zone space, particularly advertising, and how economically colonizing power might try to dialogue with a space that it is making a market, and trying to see how they perceive themselves, how they want to be represented, and how technology in general can give us these non-spatial spaces that didn't exist before, and whether the dialoguing that happens there, even though it can be instantaneous and it can be very specific, is not necessarily authentic, is not necessarily productive or accurate as to how people really are.
I don't know whether there's any such thing as an accurate view. There's only a personalized view of how people perceive themselves, and I think that's what, maybe you need to see it from the specific culture and the culture that's making the advertisement in some fashion. What about the literature folks? Is this something that's outmoded? We grab the text that comes from literary studies, not really from... we have two English...
I can speak to that.
Okay. Yeah, go for it.
I was actually thinking about this book, and Colin and I had a brief exchange at the beginning, and I was thinking about how it came out in 92, and in terms of literary theory and where it sits, it's at a pretty precarious, sort of a transitional moment in literary studies. So we're moving out of the kind of the decentering of the 80s and postmodernity studies, and moving away from Derrida into more application style studies, and moving into the 90s and multiculturalism and transnationalism, Orientalism, a lot of isms start coming about during this time period. And I guess the question for me is actually, it's more about the situation of the book and where it is and what it was useful for once upon a time in terms of highlighting what's been rendered invisible. And now the question becomes more, now that we've had it for 20 years, and the exchange Colin and I had was, what'd you pull from this? And it was all pretty common sense, and Colin and I come from fairly similar backgrounds, but it's had such a pervasive impact on the academy and the discourse that it's just understood by people who came about. I did my master's in literature in 04 to 06, and it was just understood. This was, everything was laden with this and Kaplan and a couple of others. And my question now is, as we move forward, what is it that the contact zones render invisible to us? And those would be those things like, self-perception, perception of yourself in relation to different areas, and what in what sense does going approaching something with the framework of a contact zone, what's left out? And that's more of just a question of expansion of the concept that is so appropriate now and so important and influential. Now where do we go to build on this or to develop it or take it to the next step, I suppose.
Can add to that. My question listening to this conversation has been a little bit about the expansion of the concept of contact zone, which seems really helpful, but also seems to make it maybe lose its specificity a little bit. And so where do we draw the line, or how can we seek these kind of this expansion of thinking around the idea, and still have conceptual robustness around the idea of contact zone.
I would sort of add to that to one comment. It's kind of a method question that kind of brings all this into it. I actually come from an English background, but I work with a lot of history now, and so for me, in reading this, I have some sort of background in this, but I'd never read this piece. I wasn't surprised to find that she's drawing, that it's drawing primarily sort of on a kind of rhetorical analysis, and sort of located in the realm of imperialism or neo-imperialism as a framework. I guess, and I'll sort of contrast that with reading recently and sort of developing a prospectus, the sort of past 10 years of the American Studies, American Quarterly, and thinking about how in some ways, that there was still wondering to myself, kind of in the way that you're wondering, to what extent, it seems like some in this room have found it useful to expand this in many ways, many, many different kinds of contact zones, national contact zones, even class contact zones. On the other hand, it seems like in some of the sort of American Studies discourse that it's still firmly rooted in some way in sort of the origins of this idea, in sort of in literary analysis and in an imperial or sort of neo-imperial frame. So I'm throwing that out there as sort of a question or a problem that I'm kind of working with in my own thinking, because I tend to work primarily with sort of national or intranational frames, even regional. And so for me, you know, and thinking about the contact zone, I have to, you know, I find that, you know, kind of along with what you were saying, you know, some of this does feel like it's a conversation that's been happening for 20 years. And I felt like Pratt, which I hadn't read, really articulated that in a very sort of clean and precise way, but you can also see the conceptual roominess of it, as you point out. And at what point are we kind of moving too far away from its kind of imperialistic, you know, kind of moorings? You know, at what point do we call class conflict, and not economic colonization? I mean, so those are just questions that kind of map that I'm trying to figure out.
Well, I think that's very interesting because I've been directing this program in American Studies for over 2 years now, and I don't come from the American Studies background. Mine is more of a European Studies background. And when you look at the program of the ASA compared to the program of the College Art Association, the American Studies Association seems obsessed with the imperialist project to an extent that, I don't know, maybe you could tell us what the American language, the Modern Language Association talks are, but it just was interesting to me how the talks, the sessions, the conference sessions are still very very wrapped up in that, in a way that the scholarship I see happening in our program is in some ways more fluid, and less dogmatic, so that the conference feels dogmatic to me in a way that our own program doesn't, for some reason. Maybe I'm deluding myself. Tom?
The conceptual dogma?
No, I have nothing to do with it.
No, socialism?
Yeah, it's everybody else's dogma. The stuff happening all the time.
You know, you finally put that issue on the table. I think that's excellent, actually. I think one more way of locating this in terms of literary, the development of literary theory, is it feels very much of late 80s, early 90s, power-obsessed reading of Michel Foucault, to put it way too bluntly. And one question that's been working in my mind, hearing everybody, is just whether the contact zone as a model commits us to a binary between the dominant and the subordinate, or whether that, and if that, it commits us to that model, whether we want to be so committed.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to second that, because I mean, it's exactly the point you brought up initially. In answer to what you were saying, Jared, about sort of what's new about the contact zone 20 years later, I think it is the uncoupling of you know, notions of interconnectivity and hybridity from Gramscian hegemonic theory.
Yep.
So that the special issue of last year's American Quarterly was devoted to contact between indigenous peoples, mm-hmm. and in fact, one of our American Studies students had an article, Molly Geidel, who has done a wonderful dissertation on early gender in the Peace Corps, in the early Peace Corps, and had done her field work in Bolivia, and it was. You know, there were some aspects of it that looked at sort of American imperialism. After all, the Peace Corps originated here. But you know, she was much more interested in the cross-cultural South American dynamics, and you know, that the hierarchy subcultures weren't so fixed and you know, so clearly black and white or oppositional or. And so I think that's a useful way to still keep, you know, to lean on some of the tenets of the model while not being sort of stuck in a rigid, as you say, binary.
So, and also you can have contact zones among equals. It doesn't have to be an
right.
unequal relationship.
Yeah.
this has gone longer than I thought it would. Our main purpose today is to greet each other and have some food. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.